Because the gaze transformation of the E, which is written somewhere, but I'll just write
it. Yeah, at finite level, it just transforms like N, which is the opposite.
Yeah.
So it's just that inside the trace, and just like GG inverse, GG inverse, GG inverse.
Good, yeah. So at the finite level, E goes to G inverse E G. And you put three of them together and trace it, and it's the invariant. Okay, you had a question.
Yeah, well, regarding the one I asked before.
Yeah, so you asked the question of what interpretation can give to these points.
Yeah, okay. The issue is that F is zero everywhere because of the constraint, and not yes. Delta function.
Yes, so, and this is something I was going to do later, but there's so much to do and it all ties together, I don't mind going out of order when people, okay? So here's the idea. The idea is that matter, one might consider such theories also with, quote, particles in it. And so let me go back to the action, wherever the action was. Maybe we have lost the action. There it is, sorry. Okay, so let me erase what we're not using. So this is a kind of model you can make in which you say the following. Remember, here is a space-time. So there's some two-manifold cross time. Okay. And supposing, in addition to these fields, okay, there's some world lines of particles. Okay. And of course, we have to say what we mean by that. So there's some curve. Is there another name? I was going to use gamma, but I realized that we're already using gamma and alpha for curves, for other curves. See?
Big
gamma? Okay. Big gamma. Okay. So big gamma of some parameter t. Okay. Now, so how could we make an interesting problem with a particle in it? Okay. Well, normally we could say we add to the action an action for the particle. So what could that be? Well, some of you may know, and otherwise I'm just going to say it. If we have a metric, then the action for the particle should be the geodesic equation. And the geodesic equation is the shortest distance. So if we had a metric, if I only had a metric, then we could write S particle as the integral of dt of the square root of GAB gamma dot A gamma dot B, which is the action that gives the geodesic equation, it gives the shortest distance here.
But you only need a connection for the
geodesic equation. Well, in any case, we don't have a metric. Yeah, no, you're right.
You only need a connection.
You're right that you only need a connection. Okay.
You
now we have a connection. So, hooray! So a thing to do is to write for the action. Just take the integral, ds, gamma dot. So this is dt I was using. Gamma dot a of t. Okay. So that's nice because the d by dt here cancels the dt, and this makes it parameterization independent. And just put the a there. Now, if that was electromagnetism, if that was an abelian connection, we'd be done. Okay. But we have a gauge index there, an index value in SU2. So we need something which lives on the curve and knows about SU2, so that's a charge. So I have some Q, which could also be a function of T. Or might be constant, for example. Okay? So that's a term that you can add. And actually, there's another one that you can add. You could also add, after all, we have the E, and we could also add E into gamma dot I times an object I'll call PI. Okay? So we can consider that. Okay. And if we connect with this, then let's remember how we got the, let's just follow through what the consequences of this would be. So we're finding out the constraints at some initial time, let's just call it t equals zero. Okay. And remember, I said that the Gauss's, that the constraint f equals zero came from varying the E. So if I, again, go back to the constraints, let me just put it here. We now have that the constraint f, ij, at a point, say y, I is not equal to zero, it's equal to the derivative of this by E, and this E is here, is at what point? It's at the point gamma of t, and we're evaluating that at the t, which is t equals zero. So we get f is equal, and roughly speaking, not roughly speaking, if I want to take the functional differential, I should write this as integral dt, integral d2y on the manifold, and now I can, let me just write that term, it would be the same for the other one, ea of y, and then the ea of y is coupled to an object which should have a delta function here. So when I integrate over the delta function, I get back this. So this should be delta 2 of y and gamma of t, because there's a t overall outside, times pi, if you like, of t. Sorry, pi, I didn't write it, of t. And similarly, plus ai I of y times delta 2 of y and gamma of t q I of t. Okay? So f, if I now vary by e0, then f picks up a term proportional, sorry, to delta 2 of y and gamma at the time 0 times gamma dot a at the point 0 times pa at the time 0. And I realize, I don't know, so the P is what I called Q before. So maybe, I hope, if somebody doesn't matter, I'll call this Q here something else. I'll call it J. Okay. So this is, at lambda 0, this becomes this. Okay, so the particle makes a delta function singularity. And this charge, if you like, is related to the delta function, singularity. And the same thing for the Gauss's law. The Gauss's law, gi of y, is now delta 2 of y, gamma 0, gamma dot a 0 times the j a. So if you think about Gauss's law, this is like a current. And this is like a little place where there's curvature. I mean, this is like a current in Gauss's law, and this is like a little place where, and we'll see in the geometrical interpretation, not today, that this is like a little bit of curvature, a little quanta of curvature. Okay? So in fact, these kinds of things are interesting. Now,
it's like the Ricci curvature. It's basically something which only exists on sources.
Yes.
But he's an external source that is in my hand.
It's totally. Yes. So far we put it in by hand. Now you can imagine if I had n particles here, then I would have n punctures here, and you're getting an interesting mathematical problem. So let me just point out the interesting math problem. The interesting math problem is I have a two-dimensional manifold, which is compact, could be a torus, sphere, whatever, and it has some number of points where the curvature has a delta function singularity and is otherwise zero. So the interesting math problem is to characterize the space of solutions, where, say, you fix all the p's at the points, what's the space of solutions of this when there's a number of points? And that's a very interesting math problem, and it's related to all sorts of groovy stuff. The representation theory of quantum groups, conformal field theory, there's a lot of deep stuff in there. Knot theory, representations of the Braid group, representations of von Neumann type, something or other algebras. It's a whole lot of stuff. And it also, although I haven't told you that this is 2 plus 1 gravity, it is a way to put matter into 2 plus 1 gravity. And it's a way which is much studied these days. Yes?
Sure.
It's just more complicated. Then I should give really some, The answer is yes. I'm going to demur, whatever that word is, demur, DD, whatever. I'm not going to go into it here. Okay, just because it's, it becomes complicated. And this is elegant and beautiful and complicated enough. Okay. So we're setting a lot of ground for what will be very interesting. These kinds of problems, just to tell you why there's the beautiful connection to mathematics. Imagine a braid. This also is very, is connected to physics in several different ways. Imagine a braid that we take, say, three points here and we braid them up. Okay, so we consider the case where these curves are braided up. And then we can compute things in this theory that measure the braiding. So we can get knot invariants, invariants that tell us about a braid knotted in three dimensions. We can get knot invariants from studying this physical theory. And we will do so.
So in the simpler case of the edges, it just depends on how many times you go around each point, or you just count the number of nodes you make around.
In the case of the what?
The edge.
Yes.
It's just the only thing
that. Yeah, but there's a lot of subtlety that has not yet been revealed because these are not abelian. Okay. I mean, when everything is nice and simple and abelian, like in the Arana-Fohm effect, it's kind of a one-shot thing. You know, there's a point where there's a magnetic field, and it's just...
It's more than one number.
Yeah, it's much more than one number. It's very intricate, and a lot of very beautiful mathematics is involved. And don't worry, we'll come to that, because that has a lot to do with quantum gravity in both 2 plus 1 and 3 plus 1 dimensions. One more thing to say about this theory, because we're not quite done with the observables. But I promise we will come back to talk about, but let me keep that, sorry.
If you integrate for the full transfer space to the particle, you will find an answer as opposed to a sphere in the transfer space.
Yes. Yes, it is like a flux. It's like a flux of magnetic field. Yeah, and I mean, this happens to be the same math that you use to discuss the quantum Hall effect, for example, in which these things are a little flux line.
So it's a flux generated by Q.
Yeah. But it turns out that that is the right way to discuss coupling point particles to gravity. But I have to develop more before I convince you of that. Okay. I just want to write one more thing. Because I promised you the observables. We're still in the theory with lambda equals zero. And I'm not going to turn lambda on until we've discussed another theory. Because then we can use that other theory. It is a beautiful trick we can use. But what I just said is that in a situation, let's forget the punctures. Yeah, the points where the particles are called punctures. So let's forget the punctures. So we're getting a situation where sigma is a compact manifold. It could be the two torus. And what I told you is that for every homotopy class, in pi 1 of the manifold, so we'll call that the class alpha, then T of alpha is an observable. Now, I'm not dealing with, there's some delicate issues here. I'm not telling you about relations between them. I mean, the homotopy classes, there are an infinite number of homotopy classes, say in the case of a torus or a cylinder, because I can wind around any number of times. So there are relations amongst these. They're not all independent. But for the moment, I'm satisfied with that. But this is a function just of the A. What about a function also of the E? Because the phase space has the A's and the E's, satisfying both sets of constraints, F equals zero and the Gauss's law. So I'm going to introduce another observable associated with the closed loop gamma, and I want it to be a function of the E. So there are several ways to do this, and here's one way to do it, to take, again, the curve, to consider the E at some point, gamma of S on the curve. So E at some point, gamma of S. I'll consider it in the, sorry, where it's a one form. I won't put a gauge index or an SC2 index, so I consider that as a matrix, I tie that up with a gamma dot I of S. So I tie that into a tangent vector at the point. I multiply times the H, which starts at that point, which goes around gamma. And if I have to do it, I'll always put a point S, which means that that's the S which starts and ends at that point S. And then I'm going to trace that. Then I'm going to trace that. And there's a d by ds here, which is uncomfortable because that looks like it depends on the parameterization. So I'm going to integrate that ds around. So for each point, I take an e and take the parallel transport of the holonomy, starting and ending on that point, trace it, and then integrate that ds. Okay. And that's an object that we call t1. It's a function of the loop, and it's a function of the A and the E. Okay? So, I'm just going to indicate some properties which are for exercises to show. Okay. So, one of them is that T1 is gauge invariant. Two, it's reparameterization invariant. That one, those both are trivial, but they're worth showing. Three, okay, when F equals zero and the Gauss's law is zero, which means that the covariant wedge with E is equal to zero, then T1 depends just on homotopy classes. So those are the properties, and you check them in a very similar way. The DE equation plays a similar role as the F equation, F equals zero equation, showing that it just depends on the homotopy class, which you can move the loop around. So now we have, for every homotopy class, two observables, T and T1. Are observables. So now we're ready to rock and roll, as they say, because what we want is to know what the Poisson brackets are just amongst the observables. So what we'd like to know that. Oh, hell of it. Okay. When I needed some tall person to come over here. That's okay. Sure. It's nice to know one has friends when one needs it. Okay. So what are the Poisson brackets amongst these observables, amongst the T's and the T1's? And look, it's pretty easy. I'll talk you through it. The T0's just depend on the A's, and somewhere we had the Poisson brackets of the whole theory, or I erase them. Ooh, I erase them. Okay. So the basic quantum brackets of the theory, again, are AI, I of X, EJ, capital J of Y, is the delta of everything in sight, X, Y, delta IJ, epsilon IJ, for the two forms there. So clearly, the T's with the T's are zero. So those are like the configuration variables. Now, what about a T with a T1? So let's look on a torus. Okay. These only depend on the homotopy classes. So it's not too hard to convince yourself that if I take, look, let me write out what this is. So let's take a real example, T of alpha, T1 of beta. So this is a Poisson bracket of the trace of the path order of e to the integral of A around alpha, Poisson bracket with the integral dt around beta, beta dot I, EI, H, which is just the integral of A around beta, starting and ending at the point T, traced. So the only thing that can happen is that the E can hit the A here. So in fact, I'm going to put in explicitly the Pauli matrix, the sigma I here. And then the only thing that can happen is the E here has a Poisson bracket with this. So this is equal to the integral dt, beta dot I of t, times the trace of the Pauli matrix I, this h at beta and t, and then everything that's left, and I'll just change the sign to bring it out, is the Poisson bracket of e I at the point beta of t with this trace of the path order of e to the alpha around A. So I am integrating around, so let's say that this is beta and this is alpha. I'm integrating around beta, and at each point of beta, I'm taking a Poisson bracket of E at that point with the Wilson loop, which is an integral, involves an integral around alpha. So clearly, unless the Wilson loop goes through that point at beta, it's zero. So the only way you're going to get a non-zero answer is if the curves intersect. Let's say in the case of the torus, alpha is like this and beta is like this. The only way that this Poisson bracket could be non-zero is if this curve goes through the point beta of t. And so what is this object? This object here, look, I'm taking a Poisson bracket. So this is the functional derivative. It's the same thing as the functional derivative, delta A, delta I at the point beta of t of the trace of the path order of v to the integral alpha A. Okay, so that's what I have to compute. Okay? Now, we're going to have to do that so many times that I'm going to compute that. Because that's a very basic. I think I, as much as I love matter, I will erase this now, so I won't be coming back to it.
Your paths are oriented.
Very good question. The paths are oriented. I forgot to say that the Wilson loops do not depend on the orientation for SU2. For SU2, but for a general group, they will. And that's because every representation, I've also defined it, that I'm defining this Wilson loop with a particular 2x2 representation. And I haven't yet said that we could generalize it, but for SU2, it doesn't matter. Okay. So what is delta by delta AI of x of this object H of gamma and A? Okay, so this is a functional derivative, and it's a functional derivative of a singular quantity, because this is something which is just defined on a curve. Okay. In other words, there are two issues here. So one of them is I have to reach into the path integral and pull out what I mean by taking a delta of the path integral, a delta of A in the path integral. So let me do that first. So let me think about what delta H of gamma and A is, and that's the path integral of integral of integral of A, let me consider A plus delta A around the curve. So I really mean sort of H, I really mean H, what I mean by here, yes, I'm not varying the curve, so I was imprecise about that. I mean H of A plus delta A. Okay. And delta A is always linear. So if I think of this, I only take the linear term from this. And if I think of the definition, which used to be on that board, okay, imagine that I have the 1 plus A's, the 1 plus A's, and I go 1 plus A, 1 plus A plus delta A, et cetera, all multiplied together, but I only take the term linear in delta A. So what that is going to give me is an integral, because each time in the product, I only take the term which is delta A. So I have the integral dt coming from summing over all the segments, and I have delta, and I have the term in delta A, but it has to be path ordered. So if I have, I'm taking the term, say, in delta A from this little segment here, I have the parallel transport of the holonomy up to there, then I have the little 1 plus delta A, and then I have it to here. So basically what I get is the integral dt, the h along gamma from 0 to t, and then I get the delta A, and I have a polymatrix sigma I, and I have gamma dot I, and then I have H along gamma the rest of the way from T to 1. Smearing? Well, there's no smearing. Okay. So this is what I mean by H, the term linear in delta A and H of A plus delta A. And so if I then want to know the derivative of that by delta A at some point. This is delta A at the point, I forgot to say it, but it was the most important thing, at the point gamma of t. So I want to know what is, and generally if I have some field at x, And I want to know what's the variation of that with the field at y. Okay, well, that's always the same thing as the Poisson bracket of a field at x with its momentum at y. That's where we started. And that's delta in the dimension x and y. So what I'm going to get is, if I now want to take, in other words, the delta of this over delta A, I'm going to get the product of this times this delta A over delta X. In other words, delta of H delta A, let's call it K L at some point X, is this formula, integral dt, H, let me just call it the first part of the curve and the second part of the curve. To be precise, that depends on t, but I think you know what I mean. And then delta A, j, at the point gamma of t, delta A, k, l, at the point x, and then h on the second part of the curve. And I have here the Pauli matrix and the gamma dot. And then to evaluate this, the variation of the delta A along at the curve, on the point on the curve by delta A at some arbitrary point, that just gives me the delta function. So when I'm done, I have the rather nice formula that this is integral dt, h of the first part of the curve, say up to t, gamma dot, and I'm using the wrong kind of indices here, I and I, gamma dot I of t, the sigma matrix there inserted, because the sigma matrix has been hiding out there all along, times h on the second part of the curve, broken at the point t, times delta 3 of gamma of t and x. Okay? And that's, I'm sorry, that's a bit intricate of a formula. But that's a very crucial formula that we will use over and over again. Okay, because what this is the same thing as the Poisson bracket of the E with the of the pi with the A, with the A. So this is the same thing as the Poisson bracket of gamma of A with pi and X. Sorry for making the board ugly there. So that's something we'll need over and over again. Not just in this theory, but in every theory.
Can you just say the parameters we need for both H1 and
H2? Yes, because what I mean by that is that I take H, I'm being a little bit informal. By 1, I mean I go from the beginning of the curve to the point T. And by 2, I mean I go from the point T to the end of the curve. So it's not a very, it's a heuristic notation. You understand what, is that okay? I mean, I could write, if I wrote it out, I would call this H of gamma going from 0 to T, and I would call this H of gamma going from T to 1. Okay. Okay, so is there any question about this formula? Because I'm going to use this formula over and over again. Okay, so that's what I needed to compute here. And notice now what I have. And this thing has an integral in it, and I'm going to pull out the two terms of the integral because they're interesting. Okay. So at first I have an integral dt, and the thing that I've been calling t here, so let's see, so t went along beta, And I'm going to call S going along alpha, which is what I called T over there, which I apologize for. So I have an integral dt along beta and an integral S along alpha. Okay. I have T goes along beta. Beta dot I at T. From here, this gamma is alpha. I have alpha dot, and that should be a different index j along s. Notice something beautiful. Everything is reparametrization variance. The dt cancels the d by dt, and the ds cancels the d by ds. Okay. Then I have a delta 3, which now is a delta 3 of, delta of 2, of beta of t and alpha of s. And because this is the e here, rather than the pi, there's an epsilon. So there's an epsilon ij. I should have said that there was an epsilon between. So in other words, E is equal to epsilon pi. And the formula that I have up here is the variation with respect to A. So it's the Poisson bracket of H with pi. So there's an extra epsilon when I take the Poisson bracket with E. So there's an epsilon here. So I have that whole factor there. And then I have two traces. I have the trace of poly I times H along beta from T. And since it's a closed curve, I just have from beta from here around back to itself. And then I have the trace from here of the parallel transport around alpha, gamma is alpha. Sigma I. Okay? So very simple. Two traces and a numerical factor. This is so much fun. Okay, I'll come over here. So, first, what's that numerical factor? Oops, I left my blackboard again. Anybody know what that numerical factor is?
The number of times it intersects.
Yeah, it's just the number of times it intersects. So, I mentioned that before, but let me just say again. So here is beta. Here is alpha. Here is, and this is, look, if they don't intersect, you get zero, because you're never going to pull up a non-zero term in the delta function unless there is some t and some s such that beta t is alpha of s. So they have to intersect somewhere. And then the easiest way to do the integral is, let me remember which way t and s are running. Okay, so t is running this way. It's just to make this the t coordinate and this the s coordinate, and to make alpha the curve s equals 0 and beta the curve t equals 0. And then, and so alpha is the curve in this coordinate system, t 0, and which means that alpha dot is just 0, 1, and the same thing with beta is S0, and beta dot is 1, 0. And then all of this collapses to integral dt, integral ds. All of this becomes either plus 1 or minus 1, depending on the orientation. This becomes plus or minus 1. And this just becomes delta of S of 0 and delta of T of 0. So it just becomes plus or minus 1. And if it intersected more than once, you can make that argument in a local patch around where it intersected. If it happened to go around.
Sorry, can you explain again how the orientation came into the picture?
Because I lied a little bit. This could have been plus or minus t, and this could have been plus or minus s, and then there'd be plus or minus here and plus or minus here, depending on whether they were going positively or negatively. Sorry. Okay. Then finally, I have one more identity, which is I have two matrices, M and N, and I have to trace two SU2 matrices, trace of M times sigma I, trace of N times sigma I, summed over the three Pauli matrices. Okay? And that I'll leave as a homework, but it's easier than it looks, is the trace of M times N minus the trace of M times N inverse. And I would rather not derive that for you, but if we ever develop Roger Penrose's little bug notation, it's a trivial identity. Okay, although it's not a trivial identity if you want to show it writing it out. But it's a true identity. And therefore, when everything is said and done, the Poisson bracket of T0, I'm sorry, I haven't introduced that, just T of alpha, T1 of beta, is the intersection number, the number of times the curves alpha and beta intersect, times T of alpha combined with beta. That is, I go around alpha and then I go around beta. That's the M times N minus T times alpha going around beta inverse. And that's the Poisson bracket. So I computed it. And I won't, the next one, you can do two T1s, and it's just a little bit more complicated, so I'll leave this for you to check, is that it's exactly the same, except in each case, each one has an E in it, and you get rid of the Poisson bracket of one E, so you're left with one E, so you get that one E stuck in somewhere. So that's the algebra. Yeah?
I'm just wondering, is int really a Poisson invariant? Because I mean, you can deform them so that they intersect like as many times as you want. Or do you have to like guess it goes?
Very good question. The point is that intersection is oriented. And therefore is, because if I happen to do this, I get an extra plus one and a minus one. Yes. So I wasn't going to say that, but in fact, this is homotopy invariant, and therefore so is the algebra. Okay. So we really have two objects for every homotopy element, for every element in the homotopy group, and we have an algebra which just depends on the homotopy groups. Okay, now that's why theories like this are called topological field theory, because because here we see that the all the observables and the algebra of the observables are giving information about a topological invariant of the manifold. So it is, these kinds of theories are useful to topologists and have actually been responsible for revolutions in topology over the last, since roughly the late 80s. Okay. Since I've done so much on this, I might as well pose a question, but I'm not going to answer, which is, of these, which ones are independent? So we're going to leave a question over. Okay. Which are independent? And what I mean by that question is the following. Let me just consider H of alpha. Okay. Just the, it's some SU2 element going around alpha. Okay. Now, some of that information is gauged, and some of it is not. And if I trace it, I get an object which is gauge invariant. But then there are relations between traces of matrices. And so the issue is, for example, if I take T of alpha squared, T of alpha cubed, etc. Same thing with beta, but I could take T of alpha beta, T of alpha beta inverse, you know, T of alpha squared beta, etc. How many of these are independent? And it seems at first sight a tricky question. Okay. So I'm going to leave that as a question. And we're going to want to develop eventually techniques to answer. Yes.
So does this give you all observables?
Yes. But at the moment, it gives you, it's overcomplete. But all of the observables are here in this list.
How do you prove that?
How do you prove that is you actually have to get down with the nitty gritty, as they say. You actually have to investigate the geometry and the topology of the space of flat connections on this manifold, that which is a finite dimensional space, and then you add the E's on top of it. And there's some analysis that you have to do to understand both the geometry and topology of the space of solutions. So, okay. Okay. Is everybody tired, or can we go for 5 or 10 more minutes and introduce one last thing? Or I'm happy either way. I'm happy to quit. I'm happy to. Okay. One last thing. Yeah, your friends can discuss with you afterwards. Okay. The one last thing is, I told you about Chern-Simons theory, and there's a non-abelian generalization. So,
5 minutes.
Yeah. Stop it. Okay. We discussed the Chern-Simon, the abelian Chern-Simon action for one form, which was A wedge dA. which was for a one-form A. What? Okay.
Plus two codes A with
A. I still didn't hear.
Plus two codes A with A.
But this is the abelian one.
Yeah. I didn't want to say that.
Yeah. Okay. And this has a nice property, which we use, which is that the field equation, imagine we consider this as an action. The field equation, delta S, delta A at a point, was just F. And it was actually epsilon ABC. This is the three-manifold. F is equal to 0. So this is an action that gives you zero field strength or curvature. Now the question is there a non-abelian generalization? That is there an S such that for, now let me say, for an SU2 value A, is there an S such that delta S, delta A now with an I, is epsilon ABC FBC I, where this is the whole field strength. Just to remember what it is, it's of the form of dA plus A wedge A jk epsilon I jk. Okay. So is there an action for vanishing SU2 curvature? Now, we did it a cheap way over there. We just took something else and wrote E wedge F and just varied E. But is there a way to do it without the E? And the answer is that there is. So there's a trace of A wedge dA. And then the only other thing that you can have is, so this is a theory now with just A's. So the only other way I can make a three form is some amount of A wedge A wedge A tied up IJK epsilon IJK. And the beautiful thing, and if you think about it, it almost has to work, is that there has to be some coefficient here such that when you vary here and vary here, you get this. The issue is that there's two A's here and three A's here, and there's not a three in this formula. So this is, if I've normalized correctly, it's 2/3. Yes, I'm going to say that probably next time. So this object is called the Chern-Simons action. And it's a very intricate and beautiful object. Now, just to mention an important thing, so as not to be misled, as Chern-Simon, the abelian Chern-Simon is the integral of A wedge F, abelian, because this is just dA. This is not equal to the integral of A wedge to non-abelian F. So it's not that. But it still has the property that it gives a field equation for the field strength F is equal to 0. Okay. Now, that's a very important object in physics and mathematics. And we'll come back and talk about it. So let me stop there.
15 seconds left.
Any questions? I was watching that clock. Yeah. Yes.
Do you have time to some of the objects in the middle of the page? I mean, as long as it's some sonic.
There are, yeah, there are other choices that work. It's not, yeah, it's not, it's, I mean, it's not arbitrary, but there are other choices that work.